What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to AmericaTrendsPodcast.com. And John Krofcik is with me. I'm Larry Rifkin. And I want to say one thing to you, John.
Uh-oh.
I want to be alone. Who famously said that?
I want to be alone. It sounds like Bela Lugosi. Bela Lugosi.
Well, I said it in a very deep, masculine voice. But it was
a
woman.
Suck your blood.
A real siren. I think from the 1930s. Greta Garbo.
Oh,
remember?
Okay.
I want to be alone.
Okay.
Alone. Well, that's the point today, that everybody wants a big, beautiful, and I'm not going there, a big, beautiful green lawn, John.
They do.
Why? Why this obsession
with
a lawn?
I often wonder that, you know? I mean, I cut the grass and stuff, but I don't really go crazy. But some of my neighbors are really, that's their life, it seems like, the lawn.
I know, absolutely. They're spending an inordinate amount of time, money, and putting down a lot of junk that is going into Long Island Sound near where we live.
Our wells.
And our wells, because we live in a suburban, rural area. Well, the lesson in today's podcast is that nothing, nada, zilch, in the natural environment, John, wants us to have a well-manicured lawn. The birds don't want us to have it. The worms, the bees, they want a more natural environment, a habitat that may be man-built, but that is much more in response to real-life conditions that help to keep these things coming back to our yards.
And you know what? That sounds like less work, actually.
Well, it is. And, you know, I was introduced to this, as you were, by the author who wrote the book A New Garden Ethic, who will be with us in a moment. And I've got to tell you, he gave me a whole new way of looking at the environment that I'm building in my own yard. Not that I've done a lot, though we have built an environment where we do attract a lot of birds and other species. But I've got to say that I understand now better than I ever did before this concept that he puts forward called wildness.
Yeah. Well, no, I like the idea because, I mean, bees are having problems now, and by putting more flowers and stuff that can help the bees out, I mean, I understand this concept, and I kind of like it.
Well, you know, I live on what used to be called a dead end is now called a cul-de-sac.
Oh, yes.
And I live toward the end, and I think about it all the time. Because whether the lawn looks good or it doesn't, or it's a little longer, a little shaggier than it should be, who cares? I mean, the same people see it every day. My neighbors who go down the street, the delivery men or women, the mail men or women. That's it. They're the only ones who ever see it, except when we have people over, of course. And then they ooh and ah that, oh, doesn't it look so nice? But, you know, I know it's a waste of time, effort, and money on my part. And I'm starting to try to figure out how do I undo some of the lawn that I've done. And I haven't done a real good job yet because I had put in sod before we did all this.
Right, right.
And on one side of the yard, and I shouldn't have, really.
Yeah, but, you know, I think you do it a piece at a time. I mean, I think I'm going to try this. My wife loved the idea of having flowers rather than the lawn. So, you know, you'd maybe take a patch one year and start growing out and expand from there, you know?
Well, I've got to tell you that as badly as I feel about what I do because nobody really sees it, when I think about my neighbors behind me, now, we built about 20 years ago, and there are back lots behind us.
Right.
So literally nobody sees their yards. And yet I hear, yeah. And I said to myself, what kind of satisfaction? There's nobody who's ever going to see. You could be doing anything back here. You could be, I don't know, Jeffrey Dahmer back here and nobody knows. No, it's a terrible thought. But my point is that really, I think we're going to change a lot of minds listening to this podcast.
I think so too.
about what your lawn or your yard, not your lawn, what right. your yard can be and why we should care about it environmentally for the flora and the fauna and how beautiful it can be. And I'll say this. I'm on a commission in our town, John, that really has me on an anti-blight commission.
Right. And don't check out my house, huh?
Well, I'm not. I may come down there. I may come down and check it out. No, but I have now this dueling, this competing sense in my head that I see that we're trying to go after some of these yards that people are complaining about because they're right. overgrown, and some of them are just total neglect right. of the entire right. property. But on the other hand, maybe they've got it right. And we've got it wrong.
It's possible.
Wildflowers, yes. natural environment.
Yep.
Really. I mean, who really benefits other than maybe horses when it comes to grass?
You're absolutely right. I can't think of anything that really benefits from the grass out there and the time and money you have to put into it to make it look that way.
And there are a lot of harmful impacts. Yes. Well, let's go to this. I think it's going to change your thinking
I think so
about
too.
This topic, too. The book is called A New Garden Ethic.
With us is Benjamin Vogts, and the book is called A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. And we've got you out of the garden, right? Were you in the garden today, Benjamin?
Oh, no, we're getting lots of rain, so I'm inside.
All right, you're inside today comfortably. But I've got to tell you, you really provoked me to think about my relationship to wildness. And it's not partying, it's not going out, you know, at a disco. But my relationship with the natural world. I mean, what were you trying to do with this book? Was that what you were trying to do?
Yes, and provoke is a good word because I was certainly trying to provoke and trying to provoke us to reconsider our relationship with nature and all the species we share the planet with, but also trying to provoke landscape design industry and the horticulture industry into thinking about new ways that they can impact people who buy their services and just help us all care for the planet a little bit better.
Well, I've got to give you a story. And you got to help me understand how you would frame this individual's life. I just read an article about a gentleman who lives in the concrete jungle of New York City. And he lives in a building where he basically is able to do everything he wants in his life. His job is there, so he has to take another set of elevators to get to his job. On the first level, there's all kinds of eating establishments. He is spending, Benjamin, 23 hours at least a day in his building in New York City. And he considers that to be life. What do you consider that to be?
Well, if he considers that to be life, then kudos to him. I'm not going to judge him. But since you're asking me, I think that his life is severely diminished and disconnected from the world and I'm concerned about his mental and physical health.
Well, explain.
Well, you know, if you look at students who are in the classroom, they're inside a classroom all day long, 8-9 hours, God knows how long. But if they're looking outside a window and they see complex nature, if you have complex nature, that's shrubs and trees and flowers and not just grass and not just parking lot, then their test scores can improve 7 to 26%. They'll be more creative. They'll be able to focus. And it's, you know, similar things for hospital patients. They'll be able to recover from diseases and illnesses a lot faster. So there is, and of course, urban trees clean the air and cool surfaces and all that good stuff. So there's a lot to be said for getting outside and just taking a 5 or 10 minute walk.
You weren't always into wildness or biophilia. You really came upon this, what, in your early 30s?
Yeah, I would say early 30s because I got married when I was 30, 31. So when my wife and I bought a new home, I grew up with a mother who gardened. She gardened religiously and dragged me to plant nurseries religiously. So I knew when I had my own home, I wanted to have a garden. And that first garden was 1,500 square feet, so I jumped in head over heels. So,
well, you say that our managed landscapes have forced nature out. Now, I would imagine a lot of people who are listening to this are thinking about their own yards, and they're saying, wait a minute, I planted this. I made certain that the short ones were in front, the tall ones in back. I'm doing it all for aesthetics. I mean, what are we missing about really creating that wildness that is so necessary so we can appreciate the needs of the flora and fauna around us rather than trying to sculpt it away.
Yeah, you know, you drive around town, our majority of landscapes are, they look exactly the same, so they function exactly the same. You have huge swaths of lawn. Lawn is an absolute dead zone to 95% of everything that's out there, birds and butterflies and all the stuff we appreciate, but all the stuff that makes the world actually work. And then if you look around houses in particular, but also businesses, will tend to have a very thin, maybe 3 or 4 feet deep foundation bed of plants, and it's all the same plants. And a lot of these plants tend to come from different countries, so they have not evolved with the local wildlife, so local wildlife can't use them. A really clear, easy example is monarchs and milkweed. Monarchs are a native butterfly, milkweed is a native plant, and monarchs have to have milkweed to lay their eggs on, otherwise they will not be new monarchs. And we have countless relationships like this. So if you're planting a butterfly bush or a hosta or something like that, you might have it look in the way that we've expected landscapes to look, but that's not the way that nature needs it to look in order to thrive.
Well, you give us a lot of new concepts in this book. Help us understand the difference between deep ecology and shallow ecology and what most of us practice.
Oh, that's a good question. I like that. Way to go. deep ecology. Okay, so deep ecology is basically this philosophical theory or philosophical idea that all living things on the planet carry the same or equal weight. We are all equal. Just like different skin color, different genders, we're all equal. We are also equal to birds and frogs and spiders and all that good stuff. And so, you know, that's a really radical way of thinking, especially for Western culture. Now, shallow ecology says that, okay, you know, humans are at the top of the chain still, and will always be at the top of the chain. And we can use technology to fix any of the environmental problems that we have. But it's that technology that's actually created all the environmental problems we have. Now, I'm not a Luddite or anything. I'm perfectly fine with technology. I do love my cell phone. But technology, I think, on this idea of shallow ecology, just gives us permission to say that we're better than something else. We're better than the plants around us. And I think that's what's gotten us into a lot of trouble. And it's just really dangerous to think that way.
How dismissive have we been in our culture of those other things that we might revel over when we see them, all the wildness, but we just say, well, that's an aberration. Let me get back to my finely manicured lawn and my garden and so forth, and I'll do what I want with that rather than thinking about those who are going to be using it for utility.
Right. I mean, we can still have beautiful landscapes that we enjoy to be in and others enjoy to see, but also have that utility for other organisms so that we can let other organisms also see it as beautiful and functional in a place they want to be in. You know, lawn, we just have far too much lawn in this country. We also have far too much wood mulch. I mean, wood mulch does nothing to help wildlife or insects or pollinators or any of that good stuff. So if we could just take away, you know, if you live on a quarter-acre suburban lot, if we could just take away a few more hundred square feet of lawn, you are creating an oasis, a nexus for wildlife to come in and to thrive. And just seeing that stuff come in is going to change your perspective about what you're doing and why you're doing. And maybe in 10 years, you won't have any lawn left at all. And if everybody has a few hundred square feet, then you have this connective habitat.
Well, you made me feel guilty. I'm going to tell you, Benjamin, because
wonderful.
for my own lawn in part, but also because I'm on the anti-blight commission in my town. And so
right.
I'm running around taking pictures of where wild flowers and grasses have overgrown, because that's not what we want in our communities. And we're trying to dismiss those individuals or find them and encourage them to be more like, well, most everybody else in suburbia. So you made me feel badly, but I understand your point, and believe me, that's why you provoked me to think.
Yeah, well, you know, these ordinances aren't necessarily a bad thing. They definitely do need some significant tweaking. I mean, we don't want noxious weeds taking over, and we do, you know, we don't want to encourage, you know, the spread of bad plants. So, I mean, that's okay, but, you know, here in my town, Lincoln, Nebraska, there's folks trying to change the ordinance so that people can have milkweed out front. Usually you have a weed control officer come by and say you need to mow that milkweed down. But we got to change that.
Yeah, but do you see an awakening in the United States towards some of these changes? I mean, you remind us that for all but the most recent century, our species has lived in these wilder environments, but 70 to 80% of us will soon live in or near cities. So we've sculpted all of that out of our lives.
Yes, yeah, we absolutely have. And it's not just an American phenomenon, though we have done it so quickly and so thoroughly. I think, it behooves us to rethink what we're doing and why we're doing it. Asian cultures certainly have a different perspective of the world around them and the environment. And, that's just a different perspective. I think we could learn from each other in how we approach nature and how we live with wildness around us.
Well, where do you see this new garden ethic beginning to take hold? Is it in small community gardens? Is it in urban spaces where people really have worked so hard to recreate the environment and make it more natural? Where do you see this taking place?
Well, it starts in the urban. I mean, the unfortunate reality is that if we changed our environment, our urban environments to be more wildlife friendly and have a little wilder aesthetic and wilder function, it would barely make a dent in helping wildlife across the city, the state, the country, and the planet. Agricultural fields and wider expanses and is where we're going to have to make the big difference. But we don't live there. We live in urban areas. So we need to see wildness and touch it and feel it and hear it where we are every day, where we go to work, where we go to school, where we sit with our coffee or our beer out on the back porch. And that's where it starts to engage us, where nature starts to pull us back into the fold again.
Do you worry that the next generation, the millennials, as much as baby boomers may be conflicted in all of this too, that the millennials, because of their devices and because they all seem to want to gravitate to technological centers, which are more urban, that they're really out of the loop when it comes to a conversation like this?
Oh, no, I see it just the opposite.
Oh.
Every time I talk to younger people, 20s and 30s, I can't believe I'm saying younger. I'm 41. Jeez, what happened to me? But no, every time I talk to people in their 20s and 30s, they are so much more aware, so much more awake, and their critical thinking skills about why am I doing this? What is my motivation? And is this an ethical way to do this? Is this environmentally sound way to do it? I think they're a lot more awake to the issues, cell phones or not. So I'm encouraged.
You say the gardens are one primary way to connect to the world, to lift the veil of our emotions, fears, and desires. By the way, folks, there's some really wonderful writing in this book on the new garden ethic by Benjamin Vogt. And what are you trying to say to us about the way that we can slowly rebuild our relationship with the fractured environment based on things we have done?
It can start with small steps, and I think it can crescendo really quickly. I don't know if you were like me as a kid, but you play outside, you play with sticks and mud and stuff like that. I'd like to take a bunch of adults to just sit out back and sit in their lawn or something for 10 minutes and just touch and feel and listen. But look, planting one plant can make all the difference. If you do like an aster. Asters are such an incredibly important family of plants for wildlife, and especially for pollinators. Plant one native aster outside and just sit out there for 15, 20 minutes and see what's coming to the blooms. You will be awakened in ways, I promise you, that you would not have been without that native plant supporting native pollinators.
Well, let me read again from your book, and you're tough, which I like. Our manicured and unused lawns are inflammatory words hurled at the planet, places where we forcibly cast out life. Now, many people pride themselves. They spend all day out there, and they want to make certain that they trim it up real nice and that they make it as green as possible. They fertilize it constantly. So what are you saying to many of the individuals listening to this podcast?
I'm saying that lawns are good for, are maybe good for us aesthetically, but they're just not so good for so much else on the planet. And you think about you see these commercials on TV that say you need to fertilize your lawn 3 to 4 times a year. Well, I know organic lawn managers who fertilize once a year, and they're not having all this fertilizer being washed off in a rainstorm, going in the storm drains and polluting our drinking water and aquatic life in rivers and lakes around us. Lawns need to go away. They're just, I mean, not totally. There are still aesthetic benefits, small area to kick a ball around in or something, but we don't need as much lawn, and we don't need to waste as much water. Lawn is our number one agricultural crop, but we don't eat it. We don't brew beer with it. We don't do anything with it. We just look at it.
You say we mow the world back on roadsides, health strips, business frontages, vacant lots, and parklands, beating any sense of wonder, awe, or love into submission. We've even set up laws that mandate this sort of forced submission. I mean, is our society just totally tone deaf when it comes to the things you're talking about?
I mean, certainly could be tone deaf. I mean, it takes somebody something like, what was that one psychological study? It said it takes somebody 20 times hearing a new information, new way to look at something before they even begin to consider looking at something in a new way. So, I mean, it's tone deafness, yes, but it's also just human and cultural obstinacy, which is totally natural, but we have to work against it. You know, these roadside edges, if we let them grow up to be taller, they'd be sequestering more carbon, cleaning the air, mitigating flooding from rainstorms. I mean, that's just one small example we can do in our landscapes to make a positive change in the environment and in urban environments.
How do you tie together, as you did in one of your chapters, urban wildness and social justice?
Yeah, that's another good question. You're good at this. People who have access to wildness, who have access to nature, who can afford to plant gardens in their landscapes, are going to be better off psychologically and physically. If you live in an urban area where poverty is huge, you're going to have landscapes that are concrete, that are probably going to have more chemicals in the air because there are fewer trees and fewer shrubs and fewer grasses cleaning the air. And that's going to lead to a lot of illness, physical and mental illness. So social justice, I mean, it's not just for humans. You know, like I said before, kids looking out of the classroom, hospital patients, we need nature around us. But it's not just social justice for us. You think about all the species that are going extinct, thousands per year. It's social justice for all the other species around us.
Talk about that. Well, I mean, the extinction, because E.O. Wilson, of course, has indicated that we're losing just tremendous numbers of the diversity of our planet. Explain how quickly that is deteriorating, and what role we're playing in that as it relates to our garden ethic.
Well, there are various studies that suggest how quickly it's deteriorating. I mean, there are some studies that say by the end of the century we'll have lost 50% of plant species, and some say 70% of total species on the planet. So there are scary projections, but I think it's okay to be a little scared. I mean, it certainly implicates our culture because, you know, every time we drive our car, every time we cool our home, while these are good things and things that make our lives easier, we're pumping out carbon dioxide into the air. So carbon dioxide is everywhere on the planet. There's not one spot where it isn't. So it's altering ecosystems all around the world, forests and woodlands, oceans. So everything is changing. We're acidifying the oceans. We can change this. We can stop. We can stop right now, and everything will be great for centuries. But I don't know if we'll be able to.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All so right. Well, that sure dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two, and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time and will lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
In your book, you say, simply put, plants are not art. What we do with them, how we honor their life processes as part of creating ecological function, that's art. It's frustrating when the talk is so often focused on how pretty a plant looks, and then you say, ultimately, the natural world is not here to look pretty for us. Remind us why it is here. And no, put those connections together so that somebody listening to this will never forget when they go out to till the soil or they go out next spring and they really want to do something in their yard that's perhaps different than what they've done in the past, what considerations they should take into account.
Well, I mean, let me say this. When we go out to a prairie or a woodland, we'll go out there and we'll say something is pretty, and of course it's pretty. It should be pretty. We should have that biological connection that says, oh, this is a great place. This is a place that is meaningful. It's meaningful to me. It's meaningful to all the life that's here. Now, if you come back home and you look at your landscape, compare it to the wilder landscape you were just in. I mean, it's apples and oranges. They're not the same. Something is diminished. Something is lost. And we force that loss out of our lives. And in turn, I think we have hurt ourselves. We have hurt our ability to be compassionate, to be empathetic, and not just towards other species, but towards one another. I mean, if you don't have enough compassion to plant a native plant landscape that is at least equally beautiful to you and the wildlife around you, how can you have compassion for other human beings? That's how I look at it. That sounds a little stiff.
No, a new garden ethic cultivating defiant compassion for an uncertain future. You know, just as we've had many people going around the country telling us that we've got to exercise more and having a walkable community, where do you see communities playing a role in trying to recharge the relationship between humans and the ecology in those places? Do you see places that are more aware of this? Is it out west? Where do you see this taking hold?
I think it's taking hold in a lot of places, slowly but surely. You know, we'll have some metro parks in various cities around the country where they let an area just be a little wilder. They don't, you know, let it go crazy or let musk thistle move in or something like that, but they just don't mow it all the time. That's one way. You see, okay, here's my dream, and I think this can happen. Whenever a new suburban development goes in with 100 or 200 road tract houses or whatever, wouldn't it be great if one of those lots was a community garden? And that can be, you know, part vegetable garden, part ornamental garden that's supporting wildlife, pollinators, and birds and all that good stuff. And it's like a neighborhood park, a real park that connects them to the wild environment just outside the city limits. And it can be a place to gather as a community, not just humans, but humans and wildlife. But there are good things going around. There are cities that have gardens. You look at the Lurie Garden or the Highline in New York. These places, they're. I mean, the aesthetic is very high, right? And the maintenance is very high because of where they're located. But these are landscapes that are wilder, and are saying, hey, we are still part of the wildness around us, and people are flocking to these places. They think they're gorgeous. They love to be there. So it's not like you have to have a lawn. Let's do the trees. Let's do the shrubs. Let's do the grasses. Let's do lots of flowers. Put them close together and mimic nature.
Ah, a new garden ethic, cultivating defiant compassion for an uncertain future. Benjamin Vogt, you've been terrific today. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave our audience with before we sign off?
No, I think we covered it pretty well, and I appreciate having the chance to talk with you.
No, I think it's great, and we're looking at where we're going as a society, and I hope we're going more in the direction of this reconnection that you talked about so beautifully in this book. Really, it's worth reading almost as a form of poetry. A New Garden Ethic by Benjamin Vogt. Thank you for being with us on America Trends Podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of America Trends.